Iran-nuclear issue should move together, strengthen dialogue and interaction, and prevent an escalation of the situation. As the country that unilaterally withdrew from the comprehensive agreement on the Iran nuclear issue and caused the current situation, the U.S. should demonstrate political sincerity, uphold the spirit of mutual respect, participate in dialogue and consultation, and at the same time stop its wrong practice of threats of force and exerting maximum pressure.
He added, China will continue to maintain communications with all relevant parties, actively promote peace and dialogue, and push for a diplomatic solution. Meanwhile, Moscow has expressed support for the upcoming talks between the U.S. and Iran, with Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov emphasizing such discussions could help de-escalate tensions surrounding Iran.
At an emergency meeting with Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu, United States President Donald Trump shockingly claimed that Washington is about to hold direct talks with Tehran for the first time since 2018. Trump did not provide additional details, and just last week, only indirect talks were approved by Tehran.
We're having direct talks with Iran, and they've started. It'll go on Saturday. We have a very big meeting, and we'll see what can happen. And I think everybody agrees that doing a deal would be preferable to doing the obvious. And the obvious is not something that I want to be involved with.
That came after Trump openly threatened to bomb Iran, which was dismissed as not very probable by Iran leader Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei. Trump is infamous for exaggerations, bluster, and untrustworthiness, as in his first term, he failed to honor the 2015 JCPOA agreement on Iran's nuclear energy program. Trump's remarks seem to chagrin a scandal-ridden Netanyahu, who is repeatedly accused of trying to push Trump to expand the Israeli-U.S. genocide in Gaza into a disastrous all-out regional war.
To be manipulated to allow or participate in a war on Iran and destabilize the entire region. So we are hopeful that we can continue to push him because he himself expressed the desire and hope that he will be the president of peace. So on those bases, we urged him to hold Benjamin Netanyahu accountable, not to appease him and not to give him everything he wants.
With his predecessor, Joe Biden, launching war in Ukraine and immediately joining the Israeli genocide in Gaza, many believed Trump's campaign promises to avoid more endless, unwinnable wars.
President Trump has the opportunity to establish peace in the region that is based on justice and not further any escalation or start any wars. He told the world that he wants to end wars. He doesn't want to start ones. So he can do that. He has the ability, and I hope that he has the will. If he does otherwise, he will just destroy his own legacy by his own hands.
Tehran continues to stress that it approves of bilateral relations on, quote, equal footing, that it seeks peaceful relations and peaceful resolutions to current conflicts, and complained to the United Nations Security Council about Trump's, quote, reckless and belligerent and illegal threats. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Now, China's vowed retaliation against the U.S. in response to Donald Trump's threat of additional tariffs. The Chinese Ministry of Commerce said it will fight to the end following Trump's threat of an additional 50% tariff on Chinese imports. It also condemned Trump's tariffs as unilateral bullying. China has emphasized the countermeasures taken are aimed at protecting its sovereignty and security while maintaining the normal international trade order. The remarks come as Trump's sweeping tariffs have shaken markets globally, with major indices experiencing the sharpest decline in years. Political analyst Qin Du Shou has weighed in on the U.S. president's threat of additional tariffs on China, calling it imperial bullying.
I think from the Chinese point of view, first of all, China does not have any intention to have an economic warfare with Washington. For every country that is truly sovereign, that is truly independent, you have to defend your own sovereignty. You defend your interests by legitimate means, because that's what you need to do for your people, for your nation, statehood. If you have a problem, such as Washington, said they have, you need to talk to like your trading partners to solve such a problem, to express your concern and find a way to solve the problem, a legitimate way under the international trading system. So far, obviously, Washington is not doing that. They are bullying basically every economy, every country. They are threatening with more tariffs on the goods from other countries. So this is a practice of a unilateral and imperial bullying of other countries. I think that's unacceptable for a lot of countries, including China. So I think China is resolute, saying that we have to defend our interests. If there are more tariffs upon the Chinese good, we will take appropriate measures to do our basically turn, our round, to protect our interests.
And saying with Trump's tariff war, the U.S. president has responded to the European Union's zero-for-zero tariff offer by demanding to block buy over $350 billion worth of energy from Washington to get the tariff relief. Trump made the comments during a press conference at the White House with visiting Israeli premier. He added the EU's offer of zero tariffs is just not enough to cover the bloc's $350 billion trade deficit with the U.S. EU offered a two-way zero tariff for American and EU products after Trump slapped 20% tariffs on the bloc and another 10% on all U.S. trading partners. Now, the Israeli regime presses ahead with a genocidal onslaught on Gaza, killing more civilians in the devastated territory. In the latest developments, an early morning attack targeted a home, killing at least six Palestinians and injuring several others in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza. Over a dozen people were also killed and many wounded in similar attacks on residential buildings in central Gaza. And other parts of the Palestinian territory, including Rafah to the south, were also targeted by multiple air and artillery attacks, causing dozens of fatalities. Also, a journalist succumbed to wounds he sustained in a Monday attack on a camp of media workers in the southern city of Khan Yunis. That attack left another journalist killed and a number of others wounded. The total number of deaths now since October of 2023 stands at over 50,750, with nearly 116,000 Palestinians wounded. The heads of six UN agencies have issued a grave warning on the situation in Gaza. They're calling for immediate resumption of the ceasefire there amid a deepening humanitarian crisis. Agencies warned of severe aid shortages and hunger since Israel resumed its all-out aggression on the 18th of March. They said for over a month, no commercial or humanitarian supplies have entered Gaza after Israel blocked entry of all aid trucks. Agencies noted more than 2.1 million people are trapped, bombed, and starved again, while food, medicine, fuel, and other supplies are piling up behind Gaza's closed crossings. Agencies added at least 1,000 children were killed or injured during the first week of Israel's genocide resumption, which is the highest one-week child death toll now in the past year. Joining us now from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah is Moti Abu Musab, our correspondent on the ground there. Moti, good afternoon to you. Every day we're hoping to get some decent, positive, optimistic reporting there out of Gaza. And every single day, Moti, the news continues to get grimmer, if that's a possibility. Hope you're safe and doing well. What do you have to share with us there, pal?
Yes, you are absolutely right. The kind of situation is still grim and painful for the Palestinian people in all areas of Gaza Strip. In light of the ongoing and successive Israeli massacres being committed against the Palestinian people day and night, the last night was pretty horrific for the Palestinian people. At least 40 Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children, were slaughtered by the Israeli occupation forces after the Israeli forces committed several appalling and horrific massacres. The major one took place here in Deir al-Balah city after the Israeli fighter jets destroyed a residential building in the southern outskirts of Deir al-Balah city, killing nine Palestinian civilians. Half of them were women and children. In the meantime, another attack took place in Beit Lahia city after the Israeli fighter just destroyed and pounded another house there, killing six Palestinian civilians, while more than other Palestinian people were killed also in the northern part of Gaza City after the Israeli fighter drones attacked a gathering of the Palestinian people there. And a short while ago, two Palestinian civilians were killed and targeted by the Israeli fighter drones near Netzarim Kurdo in the southern outskirts of Gaza City. By the Israeli fighter drones, they were trying and attempting to collect some firewoods in order to ignite the fire they need to cook some meals and foods for themselves and their children. And we are talking about another attack that had just taken place in the southern part of Gaza Strip near Miraj Corridor, where two Palestinian civilians were killed after they were targeted by the Israeli fighter drones as well. So we are talking about a continuation of the Israeli genocidal attacks that are still taking place. Left, right, and center are targeting more Palestinian civilians. The Israeli forces are still maintaining the same brutality and the same intensity of the attacks against the Palestinian people. And as you know, those constant and non-stop Israeli strikes are coupled with intense and extensive artillery shelling maintained against various parts of Gaza Strip. Basically, in Rafah City, we can see clearly that all areas of Rafah City are still smoldering. Several plumes of smoke are still billowing as a result of that extensive, as you know, of those extensive attacks carried out by the Israeli occupation forces from air, land, and sea. Needless to mention that hundreds of the Palestinian families are still besieged inside Rafah City after the Israeli occupation forces took control over Miraj Corridor. The Palestinian people are still surrounded from the four directions, and they are still subjected to constant and ceaseless Israeli air and artillery strikes. And needless to mention that they also do not have any access to the basic humanitarian essentials as a result of the suffocating siege imposed against them. And let me say that over the past 24 hours, the Israeli occupation forces have accelerated the detonations of the Palestinian residential buildings. Those explosions booming in Rafah City have never stopped for a while. They were deafening enough to be heard from the central area of Gaza Strip. So we are talking about hundreds of the Palestinian residential buildings that were blown up and detonated by the Israeli occupation forces. So what is happening in Rafah is another manifestation of the genocidal campaign that takes place on the ground there. And what is really horrific for the Palestinian people and extremely petrifying here is that this worst-case scenario that is taking place in Rafah City could be reiterated and repeated elsewhere in Gaza Strip amid the, as you know, the ongoing and the explicit threats of the Israeli occupation forces that they are going to expand their ground offensives and taking more lands of the Palestinian lands and territories here in Gaza Strip. And when it comes to the humanitarian situation, as you know, the humanitarian situation for the Palestinian people is beyond belief. It is over tragic and catastrophic because it is worsening severely day after day. Palestinian people are no longer able to secure even the tiny amount of the basic humanitarian essentials, the basic food items. They are still dwindling and depleting from the streets and the markets. And even when it comes to flowers, you know, the entire bakeries of Gaza Strip are completely shut down, basically, after the World Food Program, as you know, stopped its support for those bakeries as a result of the absence and the lack of the flour those bakeries need in order to operate and function. So we are talking about more layers of suffering and torment unfolding for the Palestinian people elsewhere. And the Palestinian people are still escaping, fleeing, and absconding the sheer horror of the Israeli attacks. Those attacks are still stalking them, reaching them, and killing them, unfortunately.
It is quite unfortunate. Moti, stay safe there, pal. Thank you for that reporting. We'll talk to you soon. Moti Abu Musaba joining us there from the besieged Gaza Strip, central city of Deir al-Balah. Meanwhile, huge crowds of people gathered in the Syrian capital, Damascus, as part of a global campaign to demand an end to Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. Protesters highlighted the targeting of journalists and warned of broader ambitions by Israel to expand its territorial control.
We came here to demand an end to the genocide in Gaza. What's happening there is beyond reason, and no one with a conscience can accept it. People across the world are angry and heartbroken over the atrocities. The Israeli occupation seeks to dominate the Levant, but it will never succeed. They've tried to invade both Deraa and Gaza and failed.
Today, we are in Damascus as part of the global campaign to stop the genocide that has been ongoing for over a year and a half against the Palestinian people in Gaza. More than 53,000 have been killed, thousands injured, and countless remain missing, possibly still buried beneath the rubble as a result of this systematic extermination. We must also highlight the targeting of journalists. The world must pay attention to what is happening in the West Bank. People must understand that Israel's goal is to establish a state from the river to the river, not just over Palestine or part of Syrian land.
We are here today with pride and dignity to voice our outrage and sorrow over what is happening to our people in Gaza. What is taking place is rejected by Muslims, by Palestinians, and by all of humanity. We came to release the intense emotions stirred by the horrific scenes of destruction, bombardment, and death in Gaza.
Israel Forza press ahead with the violent raids on Palestinian towns and cities across the occupied West Bank. The occupation forces stormed Nablus and abducted several Palestinians, and in a separate incident, the Israeli forces demolished a home in the village west of Bethlehem. The Palestinian Prisoners Media Office says at least 38 people have been abducted in various areas of the occupied West Bank as occupation forces continue widespread military operations. Violent raids by Israeli soldiers and settlers have significantly increased across the occupied territories since the Gaza genocide began. Meanwhile, the occupied territory saw a general strike Monday in protest at the ongoing Gaza genocide. That's a wrap for your latest, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
As if the relentless bombing and the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza were not enough, the one sanctuary where Palestinians should have felt safe became a death trap. The protection of hospitals during warfare is paramount and must be respected by all sides at all times. These were the words of UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, describing the hospitals in Gaza that should be protected under international law. The Geneva Convention states that medical units shall not be the object of attack. They shall be respected and protected at all times and shall not be used for military purposes. The wounded and sick shall be collected and cared for. Since the beginning of Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza, which has claimed the lives of over 50,000 Palestinians and wounded 113,000 others, Israel has repeatedly targeted hospitals, committing mass atrocities against those seeking refuge in medical facilities, facilities that are protected under international law. These attacks intensified with the onset of ground operations, almost destroying every major medical center in Gaza, and leading to the killing, persecution, and kidnapping of the people and the medical personnel. A ceasefire agreement was reached on January 19, 2025, with the expectation that humanitarian aid and supplies would flood Gaza, improving the health system and allowing for the urgent evacuation of patients. However, Israel failed to meet its obligation, and by March 1st, declared the complete suspension of humanitarian supplies to Gaza, including fuel, to operate remaining hospitals. On March 13th, the 53rd day of the ceasefire, a United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry published a report listing certain Israeli violations against Gaza's medical facilities as genocidal acts. How did Israel respond? On March 18th, Israel resumed its large-scale attacks across Gaza, collapsing the ceasefire and killing over 850 Palestinians. The following Sunday, on March 23rd, at least 15 civil and medical crew members went missing in Rafah following their operations there to rescue the Palestinians who were targeted and trapped by the Israeli occupation forces on the ground. Later that day at 9 p.m., Israeli bombed the male surgical department inside Nasser Medical Complex in central Khan Yunis, killing two Palestinians, including a child, and injuring eight others and rendering the entire department out of service. I'm Ahmed al-Najjar, and today for more on this to discuss the deteriorating health system under Israel's ongoing aggression, I am joined by Dr. Farouz Sidwa, an American trauma and general surgeon based in California and is now volunteering here in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza Strip. Dr. Farouz, thank you so much for joining us, for finding time amid all that you are experiencing these days.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you. So, from California to the Gaza Strip, during a very critical and challenging time and reality here in Gaza, if you could share with us your journey, what brings you here to the Gaza Strip? And we understand that you've been here in certain key periods all over the course of this genocide. You've been here last year, and you came back during the ceasefire, and now witnessing the resumption of that genocide. How would you describe the health system situation in Gaza during these three periods?
Yeah, the first time I was here was 1 year ago, March 25th to April 8th, and I was on the eastern side of Khan Yunis at European Hospital, Gaza. And that back then, the hospital basically wasn't functioning. It was because the refugees were inside the hospital, and basically the hospital was a shelter more so than a hospital. We lacked supplies. We lacked almost everything that we needed. But the biggest problem was just there was no way for a hospital to function like this. And the same was happening at Nasser. The same was happening. Literally every hospital was the same way because people had nowhere to go, nowhere that they thought was safe. So now that I'm back, Nasser was raided and put out of service by the Israelis in March of last year. So about a year ago. And in, I think, May, it reopened, maybe. And the administration decided that they won't allow refugees into the hospital again. So this has allowed the hospital to function properly, but that is the only improvement that I have seen. Otherwise, everything is worse, even before the ceasefire, honestly. Even before the ceasefire was destroyed. When I came back, it was March 6th. It was the first day I worked here. And the first case that I saw was a 24-year-old man, and he was crawling through the ruins of his apartment trying to find the body of his father, who had been killed many months ago. And the building collapsed on him, and it tore his left kidney off of his aorta. So he almost bled to death. It also broke his spine. He may never use one of his legs again. The next case I saw was a young man shot in the left chest in Rafah from the large sniper tower that the Israelis have built there. And he came in, we put a chest tube in him, we operated on him, thankfully he did okay. But all of this just shows you that the number one, the violence didn't stop. Even though there weren't major explosions happening in Khan Yunis, the explosions that happened months ago were still killing people. When their houses would collapse on them, when children would fall out of the window or off the third floor because the buildings were not stable. This is a major problem. This was a major problem. And then the shootings from the Israelis didn't stop. It was much less, of course, but it didn't stop. And the fact that the territory, Gaza, still has no normal connection to the outside world, even during the ceasefire, no normal connection to the outside world. I think you mentioned the Israelis never allowed the tents in that they were supposed to allow during the ceasefire. They never allowed the mobile homes that they were supposed to allow during the ceasefire. They never allowed the proper number of aid trucks in. They prioritized the wrong type of aid, the wrong types of food, things like snacks instead of things like meat for a population that's been malnourished for a year, and especially milk for children, things like this. And then they didn't allow for the evacuation of of wounded people like they said they would, and they tried to restrict, and in fact did restrict, the entrance of foreign medical personnel like myself, coming from the United States, from Europe, from Australia, Jordan, wherever. So overall, the situation actually just continued to get worse. It's true that from, you know, January 19th to March 18th, when there was a bit of a ceasefire, some more food got in, and there was some more water availability, some fuel came in. But on, March 2nd, I think, the Israelis closed the border again. And since then, there has been no way for people to afford protein to eat. They can only afford the bread and rice that they get from the World Central Kitchen, the World Food Program. There has been no resupply of hospitals. The Nasser still has what we need to do life-saving operations to stop people from bleeding to death. But they don't. We don't have the equipment needed to do reconstructive work. So, for example, a lot of people, including children, have had blast injuries to their arms, and they didn't die. So, alhamdulillah, thankfully, great. That's great. But they have nerve injuries. So their hands are clawing. They're not able to use their hand properly. This is going to be a disabling injury forever.
The question. The lack of supplies to Gaza, the lack of all humanitarian supplies for the people here. Since the start of that genocide, all the needs of the people have been weaponized against them. After the start of the ceasefire, the flow of aid, the improvement for the life here should have been achieved. Yet somehow it got worse. By March the 2nd, the suspension of all humanitarian supplies to Gaza, food, the cutting of power to one of the last desalination plants here in southern Gaza. And of course, how this affects the medical facilities here with the patients inside them. Now, many of the people here, the injured, the wounded, are fortunate to have such expert medical professionals like yourself. But even with that, the lack of supplies is pretty much challenging. How do you manage these challenges?
Yeah, so it's a few things. Number one, for my own work as a surgeon, we don't have all of the supplies that we would normally have, even in a poor country's hospital. We don't have wound vac supplies anymore. The certain types of sutures are harder to find. Right now, at Nasser, we do have the equipment that we need to do life-saving care, but not reconstructive care, so that people can improve their lives also. At other hospitals in Gaza, and especially in the north, the supplies are gone. There's very little that's available. They're making do with the wrong things, but they have no choice. Anesthetics are gone. Antibiotics are not available. Thankfully, here the situation is better, but it will not last forever. Because, like you said, the border is closed. So the hospital cannot purchase new material. It can't receive new material. And it's not just humanitarian aid that's not being allowed in. Nothing is being allowed into Gaza. Not normal commerce. You can't purchase something and have it shipped here. Because the Israelis simply won't allow it. It doesn't matter if you paid for it. It doesn't matter if it's donated. It's nothing. And but beyond just the surgical supplies in the hospital, the fact that people don't have clean water means they're coming in sick even before they get injured. The fact that they don't have protein to eat means that their body will not heal properly and they will not fight infections properly, no matter what we do. So, and the fact that they have no homes. I mean, in the background here, you can see every building is seriously damaged. They have no homes, no way of protecting themselves from the weather. So all of this takes a toll on the human body, slowly, slowly, slowly. And all of it is resulting in the health of people being much, much lower than it should be.
And when it comes to this resumption of the large-scale attacks across the Gaza Strip since about March 18th, how do you describe the situation in the hospital, the number of the patients, the wounded received here? How do you keep up with treating such large numbers?
Yeah, so actually the Palestinians have learned to do what we call mass casualty very well, just from a lot of experience, unfortunately. Not just in this war, but in the previous ones as well, during the Great March of Return, all these things. So they have an efficient system in place, but again, without supplies, without the needed number of surgeons, without the needed number of operating rooms, without beds. I mean, this whole ward has been destroyed, and the 26 beds that were here, we can't use anymore, because how can you house someone in this place? So it's making it very challenging to keep up with the injured. Most of them, even though we can fix their surgical problem, they're still very sick, and they need an intensive care unit, the ICU. But we don't have the supplies that are needed, or the personnel, or the infection control measures. All of this is not available. And so many patients that we save in the operating room die in the ICU later, mostly of infections, simply because we just don't have the supplies, the resources to care for them. We can't test them properly to see what infection they actually have. Here at Nasser Hospital, we don't have a neurosurgeon. The only neurosurgeons are at European hospitals. So if somebody has bleeding in their abdomen, but they also have a bad brain injury in the biggest, this is the biggest hospital in Gaza right now because Shifa is mostly non-functioning. So in the biggest hospital in any place, you would have a general trauma surgeon and a neurosurgeon. They could work on the patient at the same time. But right now, we have to stop the bleeding in the abdomen, hope that the brain injury doesn't kill them for 2 days, and then we can send them to European Hospital for brain surgery. But at that point, they don't even need it anymore. They lived, you know. So these are very, very challenging things. And again, with a population that is so sick to start with, you know, the children have not had clean water for almost 2 years. They've not gone to school for almost 2 years. They haven't eaten normally for almost 2 years. They've been displaced over and over and over again. Their levels of stress are through the roof. They're, you know, so it's a very, very challenging thing to take care of.
So speaking of this ward we are sitting right now, the male surgical department inside the Nasser Medical Complex, a ward filled with wounded people who survived the attacks of the Israelis and finally grateful to receive some sort of treatment that hopefully would help them survive the Israeli missiles, followed them where they are seeking treatment. A man and a boy, how do you respond to this?
Well, they're criminal. And in the case of the attack on this ward, actually, I was almost killed here. The emergency medical teams live on the fourth floor of the hospital, and this is the second floor. And I was coming down to change a patient of mine, his dressings. This is a 16-year-old boy named Ibrahim Barhoum. I was on my way to change his dressings, and just 10 minutes before the bombing. And I have to walk past the intensive care unit to come down here. And one of the doctors there said, "Oh, Feroz, can you help us with this other patient because they're bleeding and we don't know what to do?" So I said, "Oh, yeah, sure." So I went in there, assessed that patient. That took about 10 or 15 minutes. And then I said, "Look, we need to take this guy to the operating room." So I told the ICU, "You tell the operating room so that they can do that. And then I'm going to come change Ibrahim's dressing, and then I'll come back and we'll do the operation." But when I walked out of the ICU, that's when the bomb went off. And I assume Ibrahim was right here. I would have been standing right here working, just changing his abdomen, talking to his family, because he was going to go home the next day. He was well. So that hit me very personally, obviously. Number one, because my patient was killed. I've never had a patient killed in their hospital bed before. But number two, I've also never been that close to being killed by a military strike. So, but no, it's criminal. It's criminal in two different ways. Number one, hospitals are civilian objects in international law, and medical personnel, meaning me as a doctor or somebody as a nurse, whatever, are also protected people. And it's not just the doctors and nurses, it's actually also the administrators that work in a hospital. Basically, everyone who provides care to the wounded is protected. And that's not just part of the Fourth Geneva Convention from the 1940s, I suppose. It's actually part of the very first Geneva Convention of 1864. So we're talking about, you know, during the time of the American Civil War, things that people said should be illegal in warfare. That's what the U.S. and Israel are doing now. It's really crazy. But number two, so that's one thing. Patients medical personnel in hospitals are protected. But like you mentioned, hospitals are not to be militarized. And the Israelis have been claiming that Ismail Barhum, simply because he is in Hamas, his presence here is militarization of the hospital. They also said he's planning terrorist attacks here, but that's ridiculous. The hospital is a free area. Everybody could walk around and do whatever they wanted. Nobody saw any such thing. I looked at his picture, actually, because I'd never met him. So I looked at his picture online today. I never saw that man doing anything, walking over. They said he had been here for weeks. It's ridiculous. But so the actual facts of the matter are that he was wounded in a bombing on either the 18th or the 19th. And then he came here to seek treatment because he was probably trying to recover without being in public. But then he couldn't, so he came here to seek treatment. And not only are hospitals and medical professionals protected, but wounded combatants, leaving aside that he's not a combatant, he's just a civilian, but wounded combatants are also protected under international law. When a person is wounded in battle and then they are being cared for by a medical professional, the doctor but also the patient are protected. So it's a double crime. It's a crime to attack the hospital at all, but it's also even a crime to kill Ismail Barhum. Because, I understand he's in Hamas, he does the finances or something, but that doesn't mean you can just kill him. And we can see it very easily if we just look at Israel instead. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu had his prostate removed, so it's a surgery, in late December, I think maybe December 27th or something like that. And the next day, I'm sure from his hospital, because he was in the hospital for 4 days, I'm sure from his hospital room, he was running the Israeli war effort. So he militarized a hospital, for sure. Does anyone think that Hamas can go into that hospital and shoot him in the head? No one thinks this. It's crazy. So why is the opposite allowed? Or why is it allowed if the shoe is on the other foot?
Speaking of Benjamin Netanyahu and the militarization of hospitals, I was actually speaking to the director of field hospitals here in Gaza about the targeting of this department. And he said that nothing justifies the targeting of medical facilities. Even if Benjamin Netanyahu himself was being treated inside this hospital, nothing justifies it. Nothing allows anyone to target hospitals.
And just think about it this way. Suppose an Israeli soldier was wounded and a Palestinian brought him here to the hospital and I did surgery on him. Can Hamas bomb this hospital to kill the Israeli soldier in his bed? It's insane. Nobody would accept this.
And the Israelis just keep using this pretext of that hospitals are being used for military purposes by military groups, terrorist groups, and the Gaza Strip. But what is happening is that the Israelis themselves are coming in and turning these hospitals into military barracks. So what kind of paradoxical concept is that?
Well, it's a good question, and this is where you see that some people are considered human beings in the Western media and some people are not. Not just the Western media, the Western culture in general. The Israelis occupied Turkish Friendship Hospital, which is north of here, just outside of the Netzarim corridor. They occupied it, I think, in July and destroyed almost the entire hospital, just bit by bit, not blowing it up, just smashing this, smashing that, breaking this, breaking that. And a lot of them, the soldiers were putting videos online of them doing this. Oh, look, I'm going to smash this ultrasound machine. I'm going to smash this monitor just for fun because they were bored inside the hospital. So they turned it into a military barracks, right? Well, okay, that's militarization of the hospital. They kicked all the patients out, of course, and there was, So that's militarization of the hospital. So if Hamas were to attack Israeli soldiers in that hospital at that time, especially when there's no patients and the hospital isn't functioning, nobody would claim that this is a crime. But now, just a few days ago, maybe on the 17th, I think, maybe on the 22nd, I can't remember exactly, the Israelis went back to Turkish Friendship Hospital, laid out charges, put up a video camera outside the hospital, and just blew it up on camera. How could it possibly be justified? But this is the thing. It just doesn't matter in the Western discourse, in the United States, in Europe. It doesn't really matter. You're not allowed to just say the simple and obvious truth. The Israelis are deliberately destroying a healthcare system with the backing of the United States and Europe. You're not allowed to just say simple things that are obvious to anybody with half a brain can figure it out. You ask a 10-year-old kid to look at the evidence, they'll tell you exactly what's going on. But you're not allowed to say it. And this is what perpetuates the idea. The only way that this can come about is because Palestinians, Arabs in general, but especially Palestinians, are just not seen as human beings.
So coming to my final question, and forgive me for taking it to a personal level. On October the 2nd, 2024, you, among 99 other medical professionals who served here in Gaza during this genocide, wrote a letter to the Biden administration at the time, urging them to stop arming Israel. In it, you stated your testimonies, what you've witnessed as medical professionals, your expertise poured in that letter, and the atrocities you've witnessed. You said in it, and I quote, "I have never seen such injuries on such massive scale. With so few sources, our bombs are cutting down women and children by thousands. Their mutilated bodies are a monument of cruelty." The Biden administration is gone. Trump's administration now is in charge. Trump presented himself as the peacemaker, the anti-war president, and all of a sudden, this changed, and is now basically telling Israel to finish the job. How do you, not only as a medical professional, but as an American citizen, what do you think would convince this administration to stop arming Israel?
I don't know what would convince them, but I am a doctor, so I come to places like Gaza. I've also worked in Ukraine. I've worked in plenty of other places, too. And one of the advantages of coming to a place like this is you see that people are just human beings everywhere. Everyone wants to take care of their family. Everyone wants to have enough food to eat. Everyone wants to enjoy their culture. Nothing unusual. And the same is true here. When I go back to the United States, I can tell people about the professional work I did, which I do, but I also want people to understand that we are committing crimes in Gaza. People use the word complicit. They say America is complicit in Israel's crimes, but this isn't correct. That implies that Israel is committing the crimes and we're just in the background or something. The U.S. and Israel are committing crimes in Gaza together. It's American airplanes, it's American helicopters, it's American bombs, even the tanks, these vaunted Merkava tanks, they're basically made in the United States. So I don't accept that my government has to be involved in committing crimes against people who have done us no wrong. So what would convince the Trump administration? I don't know, but I hope something will, and I'll keep trying to find it until I can.
Dr. Farouz Sidwa, thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us and for your efforts and everything you've done here in Gaza. Thank you so much for joining us in this special program. Hope you stay safe and goodbye for now. Thank you.
selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
وَالَّذِي أَرْسَلَ رَسُولَهُ بِالْهُدَى وَدِينِ الْحَقِّ لِيُظْهِرَهُ عَلَى الدِّينِ كُلِّهِ وَلَوْ كَرِهَ الْمُشْرِكُونَ.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیبه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining a very important question, and that question is related to one of the prime virtues within Islam. As you know, Islam has given great importance to knowledge and the acquisition of knowledge. And at the peak of this, knowledge that Islam invites us to, there is the knowledge of God. According to some traditions and hadith, it's been narrated that the knowledge of God and his recognition is, in fact, the main purpose of creation. So in this connection, we want to ask today, what is the virtue of gaining knowledge of God? Or what is the result of the acquisition of such knowledge? In order to answer this question, we can take recourse to the hadith which have been narrated from the infallible imams, alayhim wassalam. By way of example, in one beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that Imam Ali alayhi salam said the following: he who attains inner knowledge of Allah has achieved perfection in his knowledge indeed. So knowledge of God is the perfection of knowledge. And if we attain knowledge of Allah, we have actually perfected our what we know and perfected our knowledge. In another beautiful tradition, it's been narrated that, again, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, the inner knowledge of Allah, glory be to Him, is the highest of knowable truths, meaning out of the things that can be known. And coincidentally, this implies that knowledge of God is attainable. Out of those things that can be known, the highest is the knowledge of God. In another beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that one who attains knowledge of God finds peace. And it also mentions the reason for this. Let's look at this beautiful hadith now. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, he whose heart finds peace in knowing Allah finds peace in being needless of Allah's creatures. What this means is that when we recognize Allah, understand who He is, and realize that He is our Creator and He has all of these great attributes, then we will feel needless of God's creatures, and this will lead to peace of mind and tranquility within our hearts. So tranquility and peace of mind has been mentioned as one of the fruits of, and one of the results of attaining the knowledge of God. In another beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, he who attains inner knowledge of God and aggrandizes Him forbids his mouth from speaking in vain and his stomach from eating, and debilitates himself through fasting and praying. So one of the virtues of, or one of the results of the knowledge of, the acquisition of the knowledge of God, is that it leads to austerity from the world. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the virtues and results of the knowledge of God in light of the hadith of the infallibles. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says the ball is in U.S. court to announce a high-level indirect negotiations with Washington on Saturday, rejecting Donald Trump's claim about direct talks. China calls on the U.S. to show political sincerity and mutual respect in negotiations with Iran, and Russia says it absolutely supports the planned talks. And Israel's continued strikes on Gaza kill more Palestinians amid fresh warnings about the deteriorating humanitarian crisis in the besieged territory. Hello, everyone, and welcome to World News. Our top story, Iran's foreign minister has rejected the U.S. President Donald Trump's claim that Tehran and Washington will hold direct talks on Iran's nuclear program. Trump made the claim on the sidelines of his meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington. And in response, Abbas Araghchi reaffirmed in social media that a Saturday meeting between Iran and the U.S. in Oman will be high level but indirect. According to media reports, Araghchi will be heading the Iranian team in the meetings with the U.S. will be represented by Special Envoy for the Middle East, Steve Witkoff. Meanwhile, China has reacted to this announcement.
Under the current situation, the relevant parties involved in the Iran nuclear issue should move together, strengthen dialogue and interaction, and prevent an